We are going to start today showing a small piece of one powerful documentary that is The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. And immediately after that, we're going to show like a small fragment, like a 10 minutes or 15 minutes fragments from the beginning of the documentary. And after that, we're going to have Kim Sipes speaking first, and he is going to talk, give us some information, very key information about the participation of labor movement in the coup d'etat against Chavez in 2002. He actually wrote a book, and actually he brings some of his books, so they are free. All of you that want to buy his book, we have some here, and we have more in other places, so please buy his book. The name of the book is FALCIO's Secrets War Against Developing Country Workers. It's a very, according to what I know, it's a very interesting book that gives a lot of facts about the participation of the U.S. Labor movement in the coup d'etat, not only in Venezuela but only in other Latin American and other developing countries. After him is going to speak the former Consul General of Venezuela in San Francisco and Chicago. And his name is Martin Sanchez, and he is not only the former Consul General from Venezuela, but also he is the creator of a website that have a lot of influence in Venezuela, especially presenting a different perspective from status quo media. We call it alternative media, and that's why we saw that was important to hear his perspective about the coup d'etat from the alternative media perspective. So let's start, and thank you again for being here. What comes next is the showing of what happened during the coup d'etat on April 11, 2002. So, as you see in this first minutes of the documentary, you can see the importance of the media in the coup d'etat, the importance of the foreign intervention in the coup d'etat, and of course, you don't see it too much in this documentary, but the involvement of the labor movement, the Venezuelan labor movement that was too connected with the international, the U.S. labor movement, was also very important. The most important scene of this documentary is that shows what happened within the presidential palace in Caracas during the coup d'etat. And this documentary happened to be in Caracas by those days. They didn't imagine that they were going to document what they finally documented. So I invite you to watch this documentary again, especially during these days. And I don't want to talk too more, and I want to ask Professor Kim Sipes to say his words.
This is probably the first time that somebody will put Chavez and Sipes in the same sentence, so I gotta celebrate that. That's a tough act to follow, let me tell you. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming. As you said, my name is Kim Sipes. I am someone who has been a scholar of the labor movement, the American labor movement, and particularly their foreign policy for the last 27 years. What a lot of people don't know is that the AFL-CIO, which is our labor center, it's sort of the coordinating body of the entire labor movement, has its own foreign policy. And this foreign policy is not done, it's not done with the knowledge of members of trade unions, but it's done behind their backs without their knowledge, and it's never reported to them. Okay, it's completely independent. So I have been studying this over the period of time, and in 2010, I brought out my book, which I titled AFL-CIO's Secret War Against Developing Country Workers, Solidarity or Sabotage. Now, let me put this in a little context before I move into the Venezuelan situation so this makes sense. The AFL-CIO leadership, like I say, behind the backs of their members, has been operating around the world. They have been operating for about 100 years. Now, this is not known to very many labor union members. This is not known even to many labor union leaders. So this is being done particularly behind their back. Now, there are a few of us that know something about it, and those that do know something think it came out of the Cold War in the late 1940s against the Soviet Union. In reality, the American Federation of Labor was involved in the Mexican Revolution in the 19-teens. So this foreign policy that's going on, that's being done, has existed for over 100 years. Now, that's important because it was rationalized for a long time as being a product of the Cold War. In reality, it preceded the Cold War, it happened during the Cold War, and as we'll see when I talk about Venezuela, it has continued since the Cold War. We still, to this day, know very, very little about it. And in my book, what I'm trying to do is pull this together, help people understand, first of all, that it's happening. And by the way, this is extremely well documented. I don't make suppositions unless I can support them. But this is extremely well documented, and I start with some of the history, the early history, and how they were involved, particularly in Mexico during the revolution there. But then the book focuses around three case studies, and that is three places where the AFL-CIO was operational. First one that I look at was in Chile in the early 70s and covering the coup against President Salvador Allende on the first September 11th, 1973. I then shift over to the Philippines. I have written a book on the radical wing of the labor movement in the Philippines, the Kilusung Mayo Uno, or May 1st movement. And I did field research out in the Philippines and documented the case that I use in this book as well. And this is a case where under Filipino law, workers can petition to have different unions represent them at the next collective bargaining round. So what happens is that if they get a certain percentage of signatures of the workers, then you have an election to see what union is going to represent the workers in the next round of negotiations. So that's unlike here, because once you get a union here, that union stays unless they're decertified. In the Philippines, it's up for grabs. And so I document this case in the largest copper mine in all of Southeast Asia with about 10,000 workers, and how a right-wing union worked together with not only corporate management, not only with the provincial version of the federal, be a comparable to the National Guard here when it's federalized only on a provincial level, as well as death squads. And I'm not exaggerating. I'm not doing anything else. But I use that example from Atlas Mines in the Philippines to document their work there. And that was with the union that was supported by the AFL-CIO. And then my third case study is the one we're here to talk about tonight, is that in Venezuela. So these operations have been going around the world. They have been directed against workers, particularly in developing countries. By the way, not only in developing countries, but they were very active in France and Italy after World War II. But my focus is on particularly the developing countries of Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Now, the thing is that this has been directly, like I say, it's been unknown to American workers. It's done behind their back, but in their name. It has primarily hurt workers in these developing countries, obviously, to install dictatorships, which they have done as a result of these operations, has been very detrimental to workers. So the AFL actually has a longer history than I even mentioned. They helped overthrow the government in Guatemala in 1954. They helped overthrow the government in Brazil. These are democratically elected governments, Brazil in 64, Chile in 73. But I go in depth in my book on the coup in 73 there. But I want to talk about Venezuela, so let me shift to that. And let me start off with reading a little bit out of this book to say how I lay this out. Massive mobilizations, strikes, street conflict, hysterical mass media, social and economic disruption. Chile in 72, 73, Venezuela in 2002 to 2004. The AFL-CIO is again on the scene, this time in Venezuela, just as it was in Chile in 1973. Once again, its operations in this country are being funded by the U.S. government. This time, the money is being laundered through the quasi-governmental National Endowment for Democracy, hidden from AFL-CIO members and the American public. Once again, it is being used to support the efforts of reactionary labor and business leaders, helping to destabilize a democratically elected government that has made major efforts to alleviate poverty, significant land reform in both urban and rural areas, and has striven to change political institutions have long worked to marginalize those at the lowest rings of society. And also like Allende's Chile, Venezuela's government under President Hugo Chavez has opposed a number of actions by the U.S. government, this time by the Bush administration. Okay, the coup was launched by parts of the Venezuelan military following a general strike led by oil company management and collaborating labor union leaders in Venezuela to remove President Hugo Chavez from office. After physically removing Chavez from the presidential palace in Caracas, Miraflores, the head of the National Business Confederation, Fedecamaras, Pedro Camarano, was sworn into office. In response to the coup, literally millions of Venezuelans swarmed to Miraflores, surrounding the palace, protesting the coup. Faced with widespread public opposition, frustrated by loyal military forces that supported President Chavez and condemned by heads of state across Latin America, the coup attempt collapsed. Chavez was returned to Miraflores unharmed, where he resumed his duties as head of state. That's the official story. That's what happened that we know of. What is not talked about in accounts, and not even in this movie, and by the way, the movie is available. If you don't know, it's on the internet for free. It's a marvelous movie. I show it often in my classes, and they like it a lot, so I highly recommend it. But it doesn't talk anything about the labor movement. Okay. And yet the labor movement, both in Venezuela, was central to the coup. But we don't hear about that. What happened? Interesting story. So let me tell you a little bit about it. All right, in Venezuela, they have a confederation called the Confederation of Venezuelan Workers. And excuse me, because I don't speak Spanish, and I'm not going to embarrass myself, so I'll have to stick with the English translations. But the CTV, the Confederation of Venezuelan Workers, is sort of like an umbrella organization for the entire labor movement. Okay, it's very parallel to the AFL-CIO in the United States, which has the same role. It's an umbrella for all the other unions. Now, the head, the most powerful union, because as we saw in the film, Venezuela is probably the fourth largest oil exporter in the world. So that makes the oil workers' union key to the labor movement there. And the man head of that was a man named Carlos Ortega. So Carlos Ortega is both the head of the oil workers union, and he's also the head of the CTV, the entire labor organization. Okay, Ortega was very much opposed to Chavez, and he worked very closely with Carmona, who later took over and was the acting president or whatever you want to call him during the coup. excuse me. But what's unknown to most people is that the AFL-CIO's foreign wing, their international wing, which is now called the American Center for International Labor Solidarity, or ACILS, or more colloquially, the Solidarity Center, was in Venezuela acting in that country. Now, I'm going to explain this in a minute, but it's part of an operation called the National Endowment for Democracy. And I'm going to later pull this out because it is relevant today. This is not just past history. And the National Endowment for Democracy is still working in Venezuela today. So I'll explain that in a minute. But the just to give a quick overview before I can continue, the National Endowment for Democracy includes their key organizations are the International Wing of the Democratic Party, the International Wing of the Republican Party, the International Wing of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and the International Wing of the AFL-CIO, the Solidarity Center. Okay, so these four organizations are operating in Venezuela. Okay, they're supporting groups, education groups that are doing no education reform. They're supporting supposedly land reform groups that's not pushing any land reform, things like that. But in the Labor Center, they're working supposedly to democratize the CTV. Now, the CTV has not been terribly democratic. And so the AFL-CIO said it was down there, it was supporting democracy. Within the CTV, the AFL-CIO said it had spent something like $20,000 furthering democracy within the government. But what they didn't tell us, although it was exposed when Ava Gollinger and Jeremy Bigwood did some research, was there was a bunch of reports going on that detailed what the Solidarity Center was doing in Venezuela. And one of the things they did with a budget of about $176,000 is that they were working to bring together different groups to support the coup. They brought together the CTV with Fede Camaras, with the Catholic Church, and with reactionary governors such as the governor of Miranda. Okay, so the AFL's Solidarity Center is actively laying the groundwork to bring some of these groups together. Now, we have to be clear here. As far as we can tell, as far as the evidence devoted to date, this coup was not initiated by Bush. If you watch the rest of the film, or if you've seen it, then you know that Chavez was seen as a threat to the elites, and much of their opposition, of course, was very racially based. So that they didn't need the U.S. to create the coup, but the U.S. supported it once it knew about it. The CIA knew about it. They knew about it in advance. And Ava Gollinger has done wonderful work to detail this. Her book, The Chavez Code, gives great details, includes copies of documents that she's unearthed. So if you want to get into this, that's an excellent place to start. All right, the coup takes place. Now, what happens in one of the things that I was able to do is that in July of 2006, I got invited to go to Venezuela. The Marin Task Force on Latin America gave me a partial scholarship, and I took advantage of it and went to Venezuela. And one of the things I did was I went to visit the CTV, because one of the questions that had been sort of lurking that no one had been able to answer is, what happened in the so-called general strike that led up to the coup? Supposedly, the workers, they had this general strike, which was the first part of the coup, to support workers. But what I found out, what I was able to document, because I had a interview with a high-level CTV official, was that the general strike was called to protest the firing of oil company management. It had nothing to do with the workers, even though the myth is that it was for the workers. All right. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't know too many labor movements that are going to go out on strike for management. I found that a little dubious. But I did confirm that in Caracas. So what happens is you have this so-called general strike emerge, but within this, there's efforts to go ahead, to go to Miraflores, to throw out Chavez, to get rid of him, and to take over. And two of the key people that were making the decision whether to go on to Caracas that day was Pedro Carmona and our friend Carlos Ortega of the CTV. They get to their rally and they decide to go on to Miraflores. They march towards the palace. They end up, there were snipers in the buildings that were shooting some of Chavez's supporters on the bridge. All of this, which is detailed in the movie, I don't need to repeat that. But what's interesting is the coup succeeded initially in that basically they surrounded the palace, the coup members surrounded the palace, they demand Chavez surrender himself, which he did, although he never resigned his position, he surrendered himself. They took him away and they installed this coup government. Now, the first thing they do is they overturn the constitution, which had been democratically voted on among the people. They got rid of the Justice Department, they Chavez had passed some laws all within constitutional processes. These were overturned, et cetera, et cetera. And they started hunting down Chavez people. They were shooting in the streets, supporters of Chavez, things like this. However, the word got out, and Martin, I think, is going to be able to talk much more about the details here, but people mobilized. And one of the things that was amazing was you get literally over a million people out of the barrios of Caracas, and they come down and they to the palace, and they surround the palace and demand their president back. The army, also part of the army, stayed loyal to Chavez, and they demanded the coup be canceled. The coup was denounced throughout the hemisphere, and basically what happened is the coup leaders disappeared. But one of the things that's happening is that the story afterwards, so the coup fails. Coup ultimately fails. Chavez is brought back to power. The constitutional government is restored. Since then, the American labor movement has tried to say that the CTV was not involved in the coup attempt. Well, that's very funny since we see them, and you see Carlos Ortega in the film where he's at—he's helping to lead the march on Miraflores. He disappears. What happens was that basically Carmona, who was this right-wing businessman, as well as some of the military leaders, betray Ortega. They turned against him and basically say, thanks for your help, now get out of here. We don't want you, okay? But Ortega had already called for the dissolution of the National Assembly even before Carmona did. But all of a sudden, now the story is, no, the CTV wasn't involved. Well, this is something that I've documented. I've looked at a range of reports, and it was very much involved. And so that basically what we've been trying to do within the labor movement is we've been trying to say what happened. Here's what happened. And what we've discovered, what we've confirmed totally, is the involvement of the CTV in the coup attempt. And we've also seen now that the AFL-CIO has lied about the CTV involvement. They've lied about their own involvement. And this is an ongoing struggle within the labor movement that's going on right now as we speak to try to overturn this foreign policy that's been carried out by the AFL-CIO. So this one aspect, this one coup attempt in Venezuela has been very important for those of us who fought that because we've been able to now document it in great detail and show exactly what had happened. And I am going to be shameless and make a plug for my book. I've got copies of my book where this is detailed that I'll be glad to sell if anybody's interested. What's this mean for larger terms? What we've established now is that the AFL-CIO has been has had its own foreign policy. The foreign policy leadership, the very top level, separate and unknown to most American trade use, has its own foreign policy. It's worked to help overthrow democratically elected governments. They've supported dictatorships in countries such as Indonesia, the Philippines, South Korea, Chile and Brazil after their coups, etc. That we've got that now well established. But what we now know also is that they're working with this National Endowment for Democracy. And this is important for Venezuela still today. This is not past history. I have to back up to explain about the National Endowment for Democracy because I think it's very crucial. During the 70s, as some of us are old enough to remember, there were great exposures about what the CIA had done around the world, how they had assassinated leaders, how they had helped overthrow governments, things like this. This became known in the early 70s, and particularly U.S. Senator Frank Church of Idaho exposed a lot of this. When Reagan got elected, when Ronald Reagan got elected president in 1980, one of the things that he did, he was shocked about this. Ronald Reagan was shocked. Now, he wasn't shocked that it happened. He was shocked that the word got out to people. That was his, that's what shocked him. All right, so anyway, what he and his group of merry pranksters came up with was this operation called the National Endowment for Democracy. Now, this is one of the most cynically named operations I've ever seen. Because, of course, who can be against democracy? It makes sense. All right, what you have to understand is they're using a different type of democracy as though it's the type we understand, and they're promoting something else. Let me explain. In other words, those of us that went to school here in the United States, we've been taught democracy means one person, one vote. If you're affected, you should have a say, things like this. It's the stuff we all got in civics classes or government classes or whatever. That's what we might call today, we might call bottom-up or popular democracy. Okay. There's another type of democracy, and it's a top-down democracy. The formal term that's been given to it is polyarchical democracy, but it also can be used a elite democracy. You'll hear that term sometimes, but it's a constrained democracy. What this type of democracy basically does is that the elites or the powers that be will get to choose who gets to run for office, what possible solutions can be devised or whatever. In other words, they limit, they constrain the democracy, and then they make a great pretense about letting the masses get to vote on what's left. Okay? So in other words, it's not the popular democracy, it's not the type of democracy that we're familiar with, that we want, but rather it's this constrained democracy from the top down, which is in antithetical. It's directly against what we know as democracy. And yet this is what the National Endowment for Democracy is promoting around the world. They've done it in Latin America. They've done it in Africa. They've done it in the Middle East. They've done it in Asia. When they talk about pushing democracy, it's this top-down democracy. And by the way, for those of you that know that we're going to have these, NATO is meeting here next month, I just heard on the radio 2 days ago that Madeleine Albright, who is head of the National Democratic Institute, which is the international wing of the Democratic Party and one of the institutes of the National Endowment for Democracy, has been here in Chicago talking in the elementary schools promoting democracy. She's promoting that top-down crap even here as we speak. I mean, history comes alive. History comes alive. So anyway, what you have is you have these four organizations, again, the National Democratic Institute, the International Republican Institute, the Center for Private Enterprise, that's the Chamber of Commerce organization, and then the Solidarity Center for the AFL-CIO, all working for the National Endowment for Democracy. So one, they're pushing this phony democracy, this constrained democracy. Second of all, every time you hear about it, it's always seen as a private NGO. That is a bald-faced lie. This organization was created by the United States government. It was passed through legislation through the U.S. Congress. It was passed by legislation through the U.S. Senate. It was signed by President Ronald Reagan. It is funded annually by our tax dollars. This is... If this endowment for democracy is independent, I can fly and my feet haven't left the ground. That's all I got to say. So what they're doing, and they're operating in countries such as Venezuela today, they're operating in Libya, they're operating in Egypt, they're operating in Syria. The democracy that they proclaim to be presenting around the world, that they're projecting around the world, has nothing to do with our type of democracy. It's a top-down, constrained democracy. So as we saw in the case in Venezuela, these people were operating to support land reform organizations that had nothing to do with land reform, education reform organizations that had nothing to do with education, and they were not supporting anything that was for the masses of Venezuela, but rather they were working to make sure that the processes, the democratic revolution that Hugo Chavez and others have been trying to advance over the last, 14 years now, that would fail, because they don't want to have that, succeed, and they want to turn back because they don't like the idea of countries being independent, of being able to make up their own foreign policy, to take care of their own people, to take care of their 80%, which is what Chavez has done from the beginning. And the policies that Chavez has been implementing And he's, you know, like everybody else, he's made mistakes. But I think overwhelmingly, the changes that he's made, the things he's instituted have been very important. They're from the bottom up and trying to create the popular democracy that the United States does not want to see in Venezuela or, for that matter, in the United States of America. But we won't make those comments. What this is showing us is, and I think, and I want to tie this back one more bit, and then one of the things I want to point out is I think the issues that this brings up, not only for Venezuela, but for the United States in general, is it raises the question, my study on the AFL-CIO foreign policy raises the question, how can we create organizations that will stay true to our interests, that will not go off on a tangent or turn against us? And I think when we hear about this Occupy movement, and hopefully as we participate in the Occupy movement that swept the country and around the world, is that what I think people are trying to do is say, we want to democratically control our lives from the bottom up. We don't want somebody else telling us what to do. We want to represent our own interests. And these are interests that we can work out if we talk among ourselves, if we gather and say, we're not going to listen to this crap anymore. We want accurate information. We want full information so that we can make the decisions that are important for running our lives. So the study that what we're seeing in Venezuela is, I believe, these processes of what's going on in Venezuela is certainly what I saw when I was there, but I think these processes in the United States are important because, you know, we tend to think, being good Americans and accepting this nationalist propaganda that we've been taught all our lives, we tend to think the United States is unique, that we're so much better than everybody else, we're ahead of everybody else. And the reality is that's simply not true. What we're seeing happening, and the struggles in Venezuela are some, but they are joined around the world. They're happening in Asia. They're happening in Latin America. They're happening in Africa. They're happening in the Middle East. Is people from the bottom are trying to take over control of their lives, and many of them are far ahead of us in the United States. They're far ahead of us. We in the United States, we... the 99%, whoever you want to call us, ordinary people, we need to catch up with the people of the rest of the world because they're ahead of us. They're addressing things. And let me give you one example, and then I'll turn this over to Martin. In 2006, the same year I went to Venezuela, 3 weeks later I was in South Africa. And I went to a workshop in Durban, South Africa on global climate change. And this was with some of the poorest people on the planet. I mean, these folks were living in shacks on the beaches. And one of the byproducts of climate change is that as the glaciers melt, as the Arctic Sea melts, the oceans are rising. And these people were already talking about what's going to happen to us, to our homes here on the beaches. How are we going to survive this? What's going to happen? These people were talking about, and these weren't educated folks. They hadn't been to college. Hell, probably most of them hadn't even been to high school, much less probably been many hadn't been to elementary school. But the point I want to try to tie in, along with this movie and our experiences from Venezuela, is that the people of the world are trying to build a new world from the bottom up where that we take control over our lives. We work for the benefit of ourselves and others like us, so that we can control a world and build a world based on social justice, economic equality, and environmental sustainability. And this is part of this overall global process. Thank you very much.